Welcome, gentle listener, to Still Dreaming, an existentialist wandering through our forever night. Thank you, dear listener, for your kind attention to this pointless rambling. What you're listening to now is a re-recording of episode 1 of the Still Dreaming podcast. To those of you who have been following this podcast since the beginning, thank you, by the way. You know, I've taken an, shall we say, extended hiatus. I'm not going to offer any excuses, but for reasons both personal and professional, I just needed to put down the microphone for a while. I'm in a place now where I feel like I should pick it up again, and I'm hoping that I can commit to releasing a new episode every 2 weeks. However, I ask for your patience if I need to delay releases occasionally. In this episode, I've slightly modified the script for episodes 1 and 2, but more importantly, I've been able to provide slightly better quality audio. If you're new to the podcast, I'll hope you continue after this with episode 3. If you're returning to the show, again, thank you, and I hope you'll find this version of the episode a little easier on the ears. So with that, let's begin, shall we? So our point of departure for this installment is the very first episode of Forever Night, entitled Dark Night, perhaps not the most original title. It originally aired on May 5th, 1992. This episode was directed by Alan Croker and written by James D. Perrault and Barney Cohen. So welcome. Here it is. The very first episode of Forever Night to air, not including the movie, of course, and the first Forever Night I had watched in many, many years. And as it started, it seemed so familiar, and yet so new. And I realized I'd never actually seen this episode before. A delight, to be sure. I knew I hadn't seen all of the episodes, but I thought I'd seen most of season 1. Now, since this series is almost 3 decades old, I'm not going to be concerned with spoilers. If you want to watch the show before hearing what I have to say, the entire series is on YouTube, wherever else it might be. So that I don't have to recount every detail of the plot, I'll give you a synopsis of the episode, this week taken from my dear friends at Wikipedia. Night shift Toronto detective Nick Knight and his new partner, Don Skanky, investigate a serial killer preying on the homeless. Unbeknownst to the police, Nick is really an 800-year-old vampire named Nicholas, brought across to the vampire world during the Crusades by Lacroix and his protege, Jeannette. When someone steals a Mayan jade cup used in a vampiric transformation ritual from a local museum, Nick falls for the museum's curator and tries to find something to connect both crimes. Reading that synopsis just reminds me, now that I'm re-recording this, how elements of the show changed, even the synopsis changes over time. As we move forward in the series, the synopsis is usually much shorter, very succinct. This one is a fucking novel. It just goes on forever. So at any rate, in addition to a warm and fuzzy traipsing down the fragmented memories of the series I have, this podcast is about somewhat more than just nostalgia, which I do try to explain in the introductory episode to this podcast. Tonight, the themes are personal identity, living with the burden of emptiness, and memory. How do we define who we are by the fleeting fragments of recollections that drift up from the fog of our minds from the past? How do those fragments get twisted and cracked, tumbling through the emotional peaks and valleys of our lives? Memory can soothe half-forgotten woes as it heightens the mundane traumas of everyday life. So while our object of analysis will be episode one of Forever Night, the lens of our inquiry will be the philosophy of the absurd, as proposed by Albert Camus. Our inquiry, how does Forever Night expose the reality of mankind's absurd existence, and how is Nick Knight deluding himself by seeking for meaning in mortality? Paris, 1228. We have a reveal of Nicholas on his first night as a vampire. Jeanette whispers, she's always whispering, isn't she? An endless parade of nights before us. In the myth of Sisyphus, Albert Camus writes about the hero of Greek myth and the story of how he got placed in his seemingly regrettable circumstances of endlessly rolling a rock up a hill just to have it roll down the other side to be pushed up again and fall again for all eternity. An endless parade of meaningless labor, of worthless exertion. But in Camus' reading, he imagined Sisyphus to be happy, not miserable. We'll delve more into that, why that is, later. Sisyphus has what Nick has, immortality, an endless string of days and nights. What Sisyphus realizes that Nick doesn't is that although Sisyphus is serving a sentence of punishment given to him by the gods, he's more free than Nick because he embraces the limitations of his condition. Nick is unsatisfied, hating life but fearing death. Nick embraces the turning into a vampire, seduced, in part no doubt, by the idea of eternity. But Nick came to hate his condition, bought with blood, to strive for a return to mortality, not because he loves life, but because he hates it, because the condition of mortality promises the release of death. As our episode rolls on, our soon-to-be-beloved characters are revealed to us in quick, efficient order. So typical of 1990s episodic television, the writing and dialogue is quick, action builds to a commercial break, after which the tension is lifted and the story resumes to get us to the next plot point. Episodic commercial television, unlike the streaming, binge-friendly, serialized fiction of today, is highly structured. Think of a crime procedural show where you can practically set your watch to the plot points. Forever Night isn't really much of a procedural, at least this episode isn't, but it has that long-past structure to its storytelling, quick, efficient, maybe sometimes a little anticlimactic. So Nick is confident, even a bit brash, and clearly, obviously, a vampire. Like, is he even doing anything to hide it? He uses his vampire mind trick on a reporter. Go home, he commands her. And she does. And no one, not one of the dozens of people around in the crowd watching this unfold, has the slightest bit to say about how odd that is. So let me say here at the beginning, I thought this program looked great. Noir lighting, Dutch angles, deep shadows, rich blue tones. I loved it. It perfectly suited the rather melodramatic acting and tone the show often picks up. And I'm just going to say it, Nick is a bit of a drama queen. In short order, we're introduced to Don Skanky, soon to become Nick's partner and cop buddy, although at first they are perhaps predictably antagonistic. And then Natalie. The dynamic between Nick and Natalie in their introduction and subsequent scenes in this episode, I think, really nails the characters' relationship. Friendly, slightly flirty, at ease with each other. Natalie immediately bosses Nick around, and he lightly resists before he acquiesces. Honestly, I thought it was the most believable relationship in the episode. And although I'm obviously biased because I know something of how the dynamic develops over the course of the series, and let me give some recognition to Catherine Disher, the actress who plays Natalie. I thought she seemed the most comfortable in her role in this episode, and she came across to me much more natural than a lot of the other actors did, even if some of her dialogue was a bit melodramatic, although nothing compared to Nick's. As much as I love the lighting and cinematography overall, why are there no lights on in the police station? Why is the chief so overdramatic? I mean, seriously, it's the night shift because it's nighttime outside. Turn on a lamp. Unless the city of Toronto didn't pay its light bill that month. We see Nick's beautiful caddy and then his warehouse loft, so totally a vampire lair of an apartment. I mean, really, Nick, are you ever subtle? No? There's a mislead for the audience. Maybe Nick is the killer? Seems like a weak fake-out to me now, but I'll give the writers the benefit of the doubt. This is the premiere episode. The audience of the time doesn't know Nick. Natalie's voice comes up over the answering machine, bossing him around again. Even though she's not physically there, Nick seems to follow her orders, at least meekly, as though he questions the validity of doing so, but can't quite fathom the alternative of not doing so. So in The Myth of Sisyphus, Camus writes, quote, "If the descent is thus sometimes performed in sorrow, it can also take place in joy. This word is not too much. Again, I fancy Sisyphus returning towards his rock, and the sorrow was in the beginning. When the images of earth cling too tightly to memory, when the call of happiness becomes too insistent, it happens that melancholy arises in man's heart. This is the rock's victory. This is the rock itself." End quote. Nick is struggling with his rock, his brutal, horrible reality of an endless parade of nights where he must hunt to survive. And while all the passions of the flesh are his to revel in, he has rejected that non-life of surface and hedonism. He tries to find meaning in his work as a police detective, working for justice, to bring peace to humanity where he used to sow pain and chaos. But this, too, is an endless and meaningless task. It's clear that Nick is searching for something. He thinks it's redemption and transformation that will lift him from sorrow to joy, from despair to love. But somewhere, I think, we see that Nick, deep inside, feels or fears that even this quest is a meaningless task. He approaches the task of everyday living like a forlorn Sisyphus, approaching the stone in grief under the weight of memory and longing. Eventually, according to Camus, Sisyphus comes to love his task, finds joy in the emptiness. Nick doesn't. All this, of course, extends from the question, what is the meaning of existence? There is no answer to this question, because, according to Camus, there is no meaning to our existence. We inevitably seek to understand our purpose. We demand answers from the universe, but the universe stays stubbornly quiet. Rather than contemplate the silence and drink deep of its profound implications for humanity, Nick thrashes about, metaphorically, for answers elsewhere. In this episode, he seeks comfort in Dr. Hunter, the love interest for the episode, and transformation with its attendant absolution through Natalie. Nick sees the rock as a hated obstacle to be overcome or destroyed. Sisyphus neither loves nor hates the stone. He accepts it for what it is. Camus writes, quote, "Like Sisyphus, humans cannot help but continue to ask after the meaning of life, only to see our answers tumble back down," end quote. By the way, Don Skanky is a dick, but in a schlubby TV kind of way that's slightly endearing. Perhaps a good indicator of how Nick is unable to accept either his current condition or his professed goal of becoming human is how he constantly is using his vampire powers. He flies, he leaps tall buildings, he uses his super hearing and sight. Nick is a dissatisfied Superman, a moody supernatural entity, unable to suppress his power, unable to fully embrace them. Uncomfortable with his choices or his potential, he is forever in between, neither godlike nor human. And he looks especially pathetic with the rather lame flying special effects in this episode. So, what a random, curious happenstance that the museum curator has found an archival photo of Nick related to the Jade Cup stolen from the Mayan exhibition. So, for context, in this episode, there are a series of so-called vampire killings. Mostly homeless people killed and drained of blood. And this is the crime spree that Nick and Skanky are investigating. Then, there's a similar killing in the museum, where a jade Mayan cup has been stolen. The cup was used in ancient Mayan blood rituals and is tied to vampirism. Because of course it is. But what I want to mention is just how immediately handsy Nick gets with the curator, Elise Hunter. They're in the museum, they're talking, they're flirting, and he is all over her. Like, when the fuck did they even meet? Did I miss something? I must have missed some dialogue or something. How long have they known each other? I don't like it. Mainly, I don't like it because I'm totally shipping Nick and Nat. And even though they haven't established a romance between Nick and Nat yet, I don't like Nick rubbing all over this Elise girl. So in this particular scene, he's tempted to bite her, and it looks like he might, but he resists at the last moment and flees. The next day at his lair, Natalie arrives. Did I mention I love Natalie in this episode? She's rather dramatic in this scene, still nowhere near the gothic melodrama that Nick is playing out. But I love her aggression. She's convinced she's right, that their plan to cure Nick will work. She threatens to leave him to his own devices, but she and Nick, and I think we, the audience, all know it's an empty threat. Now, the vampirism is like alcoholism trope is a bit overdone in the scene, in my opinion. There's an implied threat of violence in the scene, and a sense that these characters have gone through these motions before. I almost get the feeling that they have a borderline abusive relationship, lots of emotional pushing and shoving. Natalie isn't afraid of Nick, but she's smart enough to be wary, and Nick doesn't really want to hurt Nat. But he doesn't mind threatening her a little. It's an interesting angle for a TV couple. Nick reveals to Natalie that the Mayan cup could hold the cure to vampirism. He talks about Lacroix, the one who brought him across, who would possibly stop at nothing to keep Nick in his current state. In the next scene, Nick heads to the Raven. And I cannot tell you how my heart swelled with nostalgic joy when this scene started. Jeanette. So this is an exposition scene, as many scenes with Jeanette tend to be. We learn about Nick. He's been in Toronto for 3 years. He was in Chicago for a time. Jeanette drinks blood mixed with wine, and she owns the Raven Club now, because why not? She's convinced Lacroix is not the killer. Jeanette makes a comment about cigarettes not killing her. Yeah, she's a vampire. Do you get it? It's a bit on the nose. But the scene is short and gives us the information we need to move on. The end of the episode gives us the Nightcrawler on the radio. It's Lacroix, and he's taunting Nick. Lacroix reveals that he's been in Toronto for 3 weeks, which is enough time to be the killer. Nick is so distracted by his own flashbacks, he almost gets into a crash. The Nightcrawler is waiting for you. The world is beautiful, and outside there is no salvation. Camus writes this in his Nuptials. For Camus, there is no hope in death. By accepting this, we embrace the physical side of life, and because of this freedom, we experience the emotional and interpersonal side. We embrace the emptiness. We learn to love the rock, even as it tumbles down the hill again and again. But this acceptance is not the cowed, fearful submission of a beaten animal. It is the dignified, tragic hero in tension against his own understood fate. Camus extols us to live the life of the senses here, now, present, in brotherhood and solidarity with those who struggle with the absurdity of their lives. Nick, Lacroix, Jeanette are not free because they are shackled to the conditions of their past. Nick especially yearns for meaning and moral grounding, but as of yet, his cries to the universe have gone unanswered. They are dogs that know they are dogs, predatory and pack-like, but capable of dreaming to be human, mimicking the human in a perverse charade of relationships, jobs, property, hierarchies, and other trappings of humanity. In their need to justify their pain, they've convinced themselves, or at least Lacroix has, that dogs are superior to men. Nick feels the burden of his past like Sisyphus feels the weight of the stone as he pushes it up the hill. We see Nick at the end of the episode, so distracted by his memories that he loses his sense of where he is and what he's doing. Nick falls through time with his back turned on the present, like Walter Benjamin's Angel of History, caught in horror at the catastrophe of his own existence, unable to face the future. For Nick, his life is a cycle of despair, piling wreckage upon wreckage in the Benjaminian metaphor. Will he find release? Will there be comfort in a reclaimed mortality? Is death the only way out? Or can Nick find joy in the emptiness? Tune in next time, dear listener, for part two of Dark Knight. This brings us to the end of this re-release, this re-recording of episode one. I'm going to do episode two, Dark Knight, the second chapter, in a separate recording, in a separate episode, but I plan to release them on the same day, so you can enjoy them back to back. Please feel free to go back through the back catalogs with episode three and move towards the midpoint of season one, which is where we left off before I had to take my little hiatus. Thank you all very much for your kind attention to this pointless rambling, and I will see you next time on Still Dreaming, an existentialist wandering through our forever night. You can connect with Still Dreaming. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram at Still Dreaming Podcast, and on Twitter at podcast_still. Would you like to help support the show? Donation buttons can be found on our website, stilldreaming.wordpress.com. Let's pause for a word from our sponsor. Still Dreaming is a podcast hosted and recorded by me in the newly revamped CERK Internet Radio Studio. Forever Night was produced for CBS by Glenn Warren Productions and Sony Pictures Television. All rights reserved.